Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Show topics and guests focus on raising public awareness about local and regional concerns and much larger. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. When do you begin to die? It's a small question that my guest today asks from time to time to see if the answer changes. Stephen Jenkinson is a spiritual activist, author, ceremonialist, and farmer. Stephen teaches internationally and is the creator and principal instructor of Orphan Wisdom School, founded in 2010. With a master's degree from Harvard University in theology and the University of Toronto in social work, he's revolutionizing grief and dying in North America. Stephen has been redefining what it means to live and die well. Apprenticed to a master storyteller, he has worked extensively with dying people and their families, is a former program director in a major Canadian hospital, former assistant professor in a prominent Canadian medical school, consultant to palliative care and hospice organizations, an educator and advocate in helping professions. He's also a sculptor, a traditional canoe builder whose house won a Governor General's Award for Architecture. His published works includes his most recent book, Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, the new book about grief and dying and the great love of life, released just this week. Stephen was the subject of The Grief Walker, a 2008 National Film Board of Canada film that was featured recently at the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival. Today's show is live, and you can be part of our discussion by calling in with your questions or comments. To make sure your questions get on the air, however, please call in early. The number to call is 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And Stephen, I want to welcome you.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for the invite.
All of that just fascinating as an intro. I love the diversity of all, and
it's quite a wad.
It is an incredible walk. Mm. And let's begin talking about that small question that I mentioned in my intro. That what kind of answers do you commonly hear from North Americans about the question, when do we begin to die?
You'd know what I'm going to tell you. Everybody who's listening would know, quote, the answer that most readily comes to mind, and that is, well, the moment you're born. And I mean, it sounds rational. It sounds calm. It sounds studied.
It sounds knowledgeable.
Yeah, and it's none of those things. No, it's a kind of unmediated reflex. And it's actually a very modernist understanding. We have a clock that's ticking away in the studio here as we speak. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from. Hmm. It means it's a machine understanding of being alive. It comes from the winding up of a spring and the slow unwinding of it. Hmm. So literally, that's where the concept comes from. It's not that old. People think it's Buddhist. It's been around since, you know, the trees have been around. Not really, no. The second thing to say is, it's not really inevitable that you'll die at all. Again, what? But but if you reserve the understanding of what it means to be alive, let's say, for a particular kind of achievement, endurance would be part of it, sure. But there's certain qualities that all of us could start to gather our energies around that constitute being alive. Honor would be an aspect of it. Willingness to proceed in the face of mysteries without trying to kill them off. There's a lot of things that accrue to being what they used to call in the old days well-lived. No? Mm-hmm. None of these things are inevitable as a consequence of being born, right? All of them have to be learned and practiced, which means they have to be taught, which means we have to be surrounded by exemplars of what it means to live well and deeply and so on. If it's not inevitable that you're going to live well, it's not inevitable that you're going to die well either. And so dying well, in my understanding of it, is an achievement on par with learning how to love and for that to work day in and day out and things of that kind. And that has to be learned too. And if you're not surrounded by exemplars of dying well, guess what comes to you when it's your turn? Either a blank wall or all the horror stories you've ever heard that you're trying to avoid invoking, each one of which you invoke as you try to go the other way.
Mm-hmm. Your book that that I talked about, you described recently in Die Wise, that the book has a tone that's not a suggestion.
That's right.
What did you mean by that?
Well, you might as well fess up, no? It's in the subtitle. The subtitle is, first of all, Die Wise. It's not a recommendation. You can tell by the tone. It's not something I'm offering you on a smorgasbord of other possibilities. It's quite adamant sounding, and that's deliberate, only because of what I saw in all those years working in the death trade. That's where my sense of urgency about it comes from. The subtitle is a manifesto. Well, that sounds a little in the area of Che Guevara or somebody. Yes, absolutely. Well, it has a political overtone. Yes, absolutely. But it doesn't have that kind of new age synergy that we're really hoping for the real things, you know? It's not that inclusive. It's completely inclusive. It's not directed to anybody except everybody who's been born and made it through. It's directed to everybody who's going to fail to live forever. If you have other plans, don't read the book. But if you've knuckled under to that failure, then manifesto signals to you that it's not a given, in my corner of the world at least, and maybe here too, that anybody's going to vote for dying wise. Most people, in my experience, vote for not dying during the entire time that they are. Now, that you would call that schizophrenia.
Yeah.
If you use as a parallel, you heard me say this the other day at the screening, I think, you have a new child in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that child change everything? That baby and this, you know, howling at 3 a.m. and changes everything, no? Supposed to, isn't it?
Right.
Completely. And what's a mark of sanity then? That you let it change everything and that you live accordingly.
You adapt, correct.
Well, adapt, but I would go for bigger game than adapt. I would say that you have agreed that your life as it was should be the first casualty of the oncomingness of your new kid.
Yes.
You see? Uh-huh. I think that's a good thing. And one of the things that signals to the kid is, you're plenty worth it.
Yeah.
So come to your dying time with a similar understanding. What does it sound like? Well, it sounds like you got to establish the welcoming committee, not the acceptance committee.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? You accept. I mean, that's a grudging thing.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But I'm talking about, as the Dalai Lama described the Chinese, he said, my friend, the enemy. And so it is with this, no?
Mm.
I'm not saying you're supposed to be declawed and defanged and turn into a chihuahua sitting on somebody's lap when you get the news if you're dying. Not at all. I mean, being alive's habit forming, man. I love it myself. The idea that a terminal diagnosis is just going to change all that, or that you're having really sequence of bad days, so you've given up entirely on the idea of being alive, and that's required in order to die well, that's a monstrosity.
Yeah.
No, you can want to live dying.
And okay. Still be aware you're dying and still...
I would go further and I would say wanting to live in a deep way is endorsed and underwritten by the knowledge
of your
the oncomingness of your dying.
You mentioned the words death trade.
Yeah.
And you worked in the death trade
mm-hmm.
for a number of years, a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. Yes.
A little less than that, but...
Yeah.
Plenty enough time, yeah.
Yeah. And during that time, there was a lot of learning for you around how we approach or don't approach and how we embrace or don't embrace
mm-hmm.
dying.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because in your book and certainly in a lot of your work and your teachings, you are talking about who we are as a society around dying.
Yeah. Well, as a proviso, let me begin the answer by saying, as you mentioned, you know, I'm Canadian, and I don't presume for a moment that what I learned and where I learned it is necessarily applicable to anyone else. Now, as it's happened, as I've traveled over the years, it has found its place almost everywhere I've gone. But I don't presume it. Yes. So with all humility, I'd say it could well be different here. Having said that,
yes,
maybe someone will still recognize what I'm about to say.
Okay.
The reward system in the North America that I know is a reward system that mostly entombs you in competence. It's a strange set of words to put together, because generally competence is supposed to be its own reward, and you know you're crafted towards competence from a young age. You know, just do what you're good at. No,
mm-hmm.
You know that's how it all kicks in. So how do you get good at dying? What is that supposed to look like? Well, the answer is, if you don't break the spell of this competence addiction that is basically the way Western people are recognizable in the rest of the world, this horrendous fixation on being on top of your game,
mm-hmm.
Well, what is dying but a complete calamity and catastrophe? And so the reaction is to reiterate your competence. And this is what all the quality of life language is given over to. If you look at it carefully, the whole quality of life industry, which underwrites basically the hospice palliative care system, the non-medical part of it,
yeah.
Oh, even the medical part,
yeah.
It traffics in two unquestioned assumptions. One is that you're doing really well when you're competent, and the other one is when you're autonomous.
Now, Explain.
Surely. The truth is that most of the world does not treasure autonomy the way it's treasured North America. For tribal people, it's a recipe for grotesque loneliness,
yes,
and isolation. No?
Mm-hmm.
But without autonomy as a North American, you feel what? How many times did I hear dying people say, you got to help me die this week? Okay, why would that be? Well, I'm terrified of being a burden on my family. That's like the first violation of being around too long.
Yeah.
Is that you don't want to be a burden.
Yeah.
No. Burden comes from? From what? From saying I do to someone, you know, 47 years before?
Yeah.
What burden by definition mean not supposed to be like that. But if you decided to either give birth to somebody or adopt somebody or marry somebody or shack up with somebody, then you've said sooner or later it's going to end one of two ways. Either we're going to hate each other or one of us is going to die on the other.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not a failure. But you have to orchestrate your dying as if it's in the most faithful iteration of what you've come to learn and understand about life, not your greatest fears all visit upon you in one moment.
Mm-hmm.
No? So what I saw is people living their entire dying time not dying.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to say it like that so that the craziness of it begins to disentangle from what sounds compassionate.
Yeah.
You see, what sounds compassionate is as normal a life as possible under the circumstances.
Until the very end.
You
yes.
see.
Mm-hmm.
And being strong. Mm-hmm. Being strong means I can't tell.
Mm-hmm.
That's yeah. spooky.
And never give up hope.
And so on. You
yeah.
know, there's and it's a well-trodden path. And
yeah,
for all of that, it's not worn out for some bizarre reason.
Yeah.
And that kind of craziness gave me my job security, lamentably so. But the work I had was rooted in what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't rooted in people trying to find a way to do it otherwise. It was rooted in them trying to die in spite of their diagnosis, okay, and to somehow win. That was their self-appointed project or their family-endorsed project. My job was entirely self-appointed, which was to plead with them to allow to have something called that you could call dying-centered care, not patient-centered care or any one-centered care. And so the dying person is not the center. It's the dying. The dying is to be served and learned. And we practice truancy. That's what I learned.
So with the term, you actually use the term the selling of quality of life at the end of people's lives is kind of a methadone approach
yeah.
to the dilemma of dying.
Right.
And it kind of keeps it wet.
Well, I chose the image of methadone for those who are not alert to this. Methadone, I don't know if it's discredited anymore, but when I was active in the business, methadone was used to treat drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of allegedly non-addictive alternative to the, you know, crack or whatever it was, mm-hmm. that was bedeviling people's lives. What it does completely is keep in check and completely unchallenged the intactness of the addictive orientation to anything. You just change the thing for something less caustic or what have you. Yeah. I'm not judging it, but I'm acknowledging that this seems to be the dynamic. No?
Yeah.
So hope or quality of life is the methadone for dying people who are refusing to die, who want as much of their life as possible to be, to not register that they're dying.
Yeah.
You see, so hope sounds life-affirming, but it isn't. There's nothing life-affirming about life, about hope. What hope whispers is the present is not good enough, okay? It's all future-oriented. All hopeful people are future junkies. You got to have a future in which this hope cashes out, you see? And if you don't have that, there's no room for hope. How do you be hopeful and dying at the same time? What are you supposed to be hoping for? That you're not dying as you are? What does that deliver you to? Madness. Or you're not allowed to know what's happening to you? Or we're going to have a debate at the end of the hospital corridor about whether Dad's allowed to be told that this is because it would kill him.
I mean, he'll
give up.
Horrible. He would give
yeah,
up.
Yeah, quality of life would go down. No. Right. Oh, God forbid he should know. And because he's 76, well, he's incapable of really understanding anything. What? Well, you understand. Look, he'll be upset. He'll be, you know, throwing stuff
sad.
Through the window.
Very
I hope sad.
Yes.
But it's not a given either.
Yeah.
Anger is more likely.
Yeah. You know?
And then why'd you tell me? And all the accusations begin to fly. Mm-hmm. And then the sister says, I told you so, and off we go. Well, the whole predicate of this whole family consternation is what? That it's kinder not to know? There's nothing kind about that kind of truancy. It lets you off the meat hook of being a living human being, and you become a maniac cheerleader instead. So, only half jokingly, apropos of the methadone idea, I used to say, when the question of more sedation came up right towards the end, you know, and I would say, well, this is a novel approach. It's a little risky, but let's consider this option. What's that? Well, let's sedate the family and see how the patient does with a very moderate amount, but give the family plenty of sedation so that their outward signs of distress and also are kind of managed. Well, I'm only half joking, okay, because of what I saw, no? Families are not their dying kin's best friend.
No.
If they're in the cheerleading business.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I know this sounds intolerant, okay? It sounds strident and doctrinaire. It's not a matter of opinion.
And you're not trying to be flippant.
Completely not.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see my face.
Yeah, I can.
I'm in earnest here.
Yes.
Okay, but here's why. I'm not trafficking in opinions right now. I'm telling you and the people who are listening what I saw. And I'm faithful to it. I'm not even translating it to what we should do, okay, because that's Dr. Phil land. The land I live in is if we're willing to be a faithful witness, it means we're a grown-up and we're trustworthy as an adult. And there are kids 5 and 7 and 12 and 17 who are watching us for a sign of what sanity and what being a grown-up looks like. And if you bail on all that stuff then, don't be surprised that 40 years down the road, that 17-year-old who's that now the power of attorney for you
is going to bail on you
is going to be activated by the crazy example you set 40 years before.
So
you just do the math, man.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices. If you just joined us and would like to hear this entire show, you can go to website at kcbx.org and use the drop down menu for News Talk and click on Central Coast Voices and listen to the show. My guest that you're hearing now is Stephen Jenkinson, a spiritual activist, author, ceremonialist, and farmer. Stephen teaches internationally and is the creator and principal instructor of the Orphan Wisdom School, and he's worked extensively with dying people in their families and is revolutionizing grief and dying in North America by redefining what it means to live, die, and die well. We have about 40 minutes left in this show, and there's time for your questions and comments. So if you want to bring your voice to our discussion, please call us at 781-3875. That's 781-3875. And Stephen, you have it, throughout the book Die Wise, which is your most recent release and just came out this week, there are, you know, you don't put sugar on things. You do tell a lot of stories and share a lot of circumstances that you encountered in your work with families and individuals who mm-hmm. are dying that are illustrations of what you're talking about. And mm-hmm. I'm sure just a small amount of the people that you encountered.
True.
And you've had so many of those encounters with what you're saying and what you've written in your book. How did that work with you working within the palliative care industry and the death trade?
The dirt. Well, I mean, you've already figured it out, you know, that there was, we could put it this way. It was a time-limited offer for me to be there. You know, there was nothing nefarious at the beginning. I was honestly offered a position. I very reluctantly took it with a lot of, you know, happy pressure from well-intended people. But I knew I wasn't organizational material. It's a good thing to know about yourself.
Yeah, it's a great thing.
You know, and so I kind of ran counter to my own inclinations for the sake of being able to perhaps be useful in a place I never anticipated I would be. I mean, that's how grandiose it was. It was not a big thing going in there. Mm-hmm. And I thought my job was to help people die well.
Yes.
And it took a while, I'm telling you, not the first week. It took a while to realize I was basically the only one who thought that was what the job was. Mm-hmm. Dying well in a death-phobic culture is a completely counterintuitive proposition, unless you recalibrate the whole thing so that dying well means the least possible death.
Say that
sure,
another
I'll
way.
Sure, I'll say it differently.
Yeah.
By least possible death, I mean we certainly traffic in the idea that knowing that you could be dying is the principal vector for suffering. I mean, of the deep existential kind.
Yes.
This is where the discussion comes from as to whether people should be told. And if so, how? It's a whole art form.
Yeah.
How to tell, quote, people that they're going to die. Well, do you hear the tense of the verb? It's always the future tense.
Yes, you're going to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, rather than you're dying.
So all of a sudden dying is like the last 7 minutes.
Yeah.
That's what, and before that it's all preparatory. But in actual fact, dying is, it's a prolonged proposition.
Yes.
And the best way to illustrate is to say, as a farmer, I'm often asked, you know, horticultural advice, when's the best time to plant a tree? The answer is about 25 years ago. If you want a tree, you should have planted it 25 years ago. You want a windbreak and so on. Well, it's the same thing with dying. When's a good time to start dying? Well, if you wait for a terminal diagnosis, you're kind of playing brinksmanship as if you have the capacity to hit the ground running there just because yeah. someone's given you this piece of advice or news. I always said, turning the corner from the future tense, I'm going to die, to the present tense, I'm dying. That's basically the Rubicon in a death-phobic culture.
Yeah.
So as long as you can resist it and say, there's treatment options, and there's another round of chemo, and there's still some blood tests, there's something we can do, translates as, we haven't given up, which means you ain't dying yet.
Yeah.
So when do you get to die? When you got nothing to bring to it, that you're spent absolutely at its limit and beyond, mm-hmm. right? You're unrecognizable to yourself. This is a good time to undergo this entire existential, spiritual, yes, medical, family project of learning how to die when you got nothing.
Yeah.
But that's what we ask of people.
Yes.
And then we wonder why we use so much sedation at the end of life.
Yeah.
Well, this is a principal reason why.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have a call here. We're going to talk to Giselle. Giselle, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi, thank you for calling. Did you have a question or a comment?
I have one question and one comment. I'll start with the question first. Do you think dying people should be given access to a telephone?
Wow, I've never been asked that before. obviously, I don't know why you're asking, but I couldn't imagine why not.
I think they should.
Okay.
But I've been in two situations where the relatives thought it was intrusive.
Oh, I see. For the ringing and so on.
I'm not sure what their thinking was.
Okay. Well, regardless of that, we could say, of course, you know, what I found is when people are quite close to dying, I mean, you know, hours to a few days away, they become kind of sensitized in a way that you wouldn't expect, because visually it looks like everything's closing down. They're not responsive anymore. They're slack-jawed. They don't focus if they open their eyes at all, and all the rest. But it's not unlike what you've heard about people who suddenly go blind, that there are other senses that somehow compensate and become accentuated as a result. And what I saw is that dying people, their sense of everything is accentuated while all their individual senses are shutting down, which is to say that there should be a real protocol, a real etiquette of how we are around people who are dying that should include being alert to the fact that they're very attuned to the feeling state of the people who come and attend to them in their last hours. And so a certain calm and deep dignity is required. Generally speaking, telephones don't go with that tone. So
right.
On that point, I'd agree with you. Probably, it sounds like a good idea in terms of being in contact, but in the last days, nobody's going to make any phone calls, generally.
I think the hard part is the period of time just before what you're describing, because a few minutes ago you were talking about still exploring different avenues, which I think also is to relieve pain. Or
are you talking about palliative care?
I don't know what the word palliative really means.
Okay.
Would you like me to tell you?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Now, you should be sitting down for this one, because it's quite a big deal. Okay. Now, palliative care, if you look in a textbook or the dictionary right now, it'll say something like comfort-giving measures as opposed to curative measures. And therefore, it's tuned to so-called end-of-life care. Now, the actual etymology of the word is Latin, and it's quite old, and it refers to a cloak or a shroud, which means the verb to palliate in its original intent means to cover or conceal. And I submit to you that most of what passes for medical palliative care and a good deal of counseling is engaged in this shrouding and concealing for the sake of the person who's dying, though. That's the motivation, to ease, to quiet down, and to make less than direct, you know, what's actually happening. So that's now you know what the word actually means.
So, for example, in the case of my friend, he was lucky in that he said that he didn't have a lot of pain, but there was swelling, I guess a buildup of fluid.
Fluid, yeah.
And that bothered him, and there was some disagreement between him and his doctor whether the doctor should drain the fluid, because the doctor was afraid if he did that it would just leave space for the cancer. So, you know, whether the doctor should have honored his desire, I don't know if that would be considered palliative, because it really didn't cure him.
Uh-huh. Well, one way to come at this in a slightly different direction is to say, you know, when you're dying, it doesn't mean that you're the boss. It doesn't mean that you understand everything that's happening necessarily. It doesn't make you an expert. I know this doesn't go down well with some people listening even now, because we want to confer upon the dying person this kind of magisterial wisdom suddenly that's never been in evidence, particularly in the rest of their days. Well, they don't have it when they're dying either. So it's important to grant the various medical specialties their wisdom and their practice and, you know, their efficacy. Where the rubber hits the road is this difference of opinion you've said, and I would say that the decision-making should always be conducted in the presence of, from the family point of view, what memories do you want to have 5 or 10 years from now? Well, you're crafting those memories as we go, from moment to moment. Please proceed accordingly, rather than, well, this is what Dad would want, and all of the pontificating that goes on around this. Prior to that, you hope that the dying person is as clear as they can possibly be about what they think a good idea for themselves would be, and then you hope that not too much goes crazy, whereby that can be delivered upon. But it's not a given at all, friends. Please go easy on the people who are trying to find their way professionally in all of this. It's not as obvious or simple for them just because they've done it before.
Mm, that's a good point. And we have Nancy. Nancy, did you have a question or a comment?
Oh, yes, I had a comment because I don't know how I've known, but I've known for a long time that the moment we arrive here, what we call here, we are both living and dying. It's a mutual arising. You aren't going to get one without the other. And we're so unrealistic about it that there's so much that happens, and people get spooked, and they do all kinds of unusual things. But I have a directive for the end of life, and I have wanted to make sure that my family would honor that, that they wouldn't, at the last minute, kind of, you know, try to do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had experiences in life that tell me it's not a big deal to die. I've been pretty close several times, so it isn't a big deal. And I wish we could get past that so that we could live very differently on this planet. You know, we've soiled the nest here so much that we don't know who we are.
Well, here's another possibility, Nancy. It could be this. What if we, as a people in North America, if we decided, which is what it would have to be, that we do know that we're going to die, that our life is not bottomless and unrestrained. It's completely restrained. And if we knew that, what would living accordingly look like? I'd suggest to you, it would look exactly as you think it would look if we decided dying was no big deal. Dying is no big deal, for me, is born when you say that living is no big deal. I think both of them are enormous. Both of them are tremendous privileges of a kind, not terribly sought out, but to get it right, you see. And when you know that you're not going to get another 5 or 10 years, maybe, just maybe, you have to... Something alights inside you with a hunger to get it right, you know, to leave behind you some kind of story that's worth hearing. Not a hero story, a story of a human-scaled, mysterious dying that testifies to how gorgeous it is to be alive. I think the ability to do that is underwritten by knowing that dying's quite a big deal after all.
You had written, Stephen, in your book that we are challenged by two riddles. And I found this.
Please remind me, because...
This is... I'm not going to ask you to remember your whole book.
Right, here, okay.
But all the deaths of a living... all the deaths of all living things feed life.
Right.
What does ours feed?
Right.
All of life's deaths mean that life continues. What does our death mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's really not a common way that we look at how we're part of the whole experience of living.
If we are.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to say. That's why I didn't call them questions. I called them riddles.
Yeah.
Riddles doesn't mean don't try to answer them. Mm. Riddles means every time you try to answer them, your sort of received and basically undigested series of opinions takes a real hit, you know? You're going, wait a second. Well, we're part of life. Really? Well, then show in our way of dying that we actually believe that and think it's a good thing. So you're 6 feet under, entombed in concrete, you're full of formaldehyde, whatever else, all right? I know people are saying, that's changing. Well, it's changing not because our understanding of dying is, or living is changing. It's changing mostly out of a change in fashion. You know, it's not as green, right? It's not as kind. I mean, there's two toxic places on this world guaranteed that you're going to be in. One of them is cemeteries and the other one's golf courses. Okay, maybe not guaranteed on the golf course thing, but and they're both toxic for the same reasons, because of what we're pouring in there to keep them looking like they do. Mm-hmm. So when we die our kind of death, you know, rancorous, refusing, argumentative, belligerent, feeling ripped off, feeling that we didn't get our due, you know, portion, etc. What we're saying is that this is beneath us. And our dying practices and our death practices certainly elaborate that this is beneath us. So when I say it's death that feeds life, it's such an obvious statement to make ecologically, mm-hmm. if you think about it. I hold up earth in my hand when I'm teaching. I ask people, what is it? They'll say everything but death. Nobody says death. Hmm. Oh, it's Gaia. You know, it's the mother. It's the, you know, life principle. It's all that. No, it's death. You don't get that stuff in your hand from stuff living forever. No. All earth comes from stuff dying. But then people say decayed vegetable matter. Well, it's just vegetables? Come on now. What about Uncle Frank? Never shows up in the architecture, no? So until dying is legitimate consequence of being conceived, entirely just, until our way of dying actually gives itself to the generations to come, not just human generations, but all living generations, until that happens and it's visible and it's part of our way we raise children and with the way we teach the life cycle and so on, don't be surprised that we come to it argumentative and like dissatisfied consumers, you know, returning something at the customer service desk because it doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and wanting a transplant here and a hip replacement there and a bypass here and, you know, one more blood test when you can't even see straight anymore. Well, these are all ways of opting out of the deal. Opting back in is deciding that your way of dying is one of the things that can sustain those to come. The stories that are told, the way it's understood, not that you're a hero, that you're a human, that you gave your last days to what's to come instead of trying to keep them for yourself, mm-hmm. or for those who claim to love you. No? That's a bit of what was going on.
Yeah, there. Yeah. In your film, The Grief Walker, you had individuals that were featured in the film, and you had said when you were speaking after the film showed at the film festival that those individuals really shared themselves during those films and in during the filming and
filming,
and
yeah. mm-hmm.
You know, really spectacularly and
nakedly too,
and very nakedly,
yeah.
And in the filming, there was a lot of the filming that ended up not being in the film.
Sure,
I think you mentioned there was over 200 hours
yeah,
that.
That's right.
That didn't show up in the mm-hmm. film, you know. As you're recalling some of the stories of some of the people that were sharing themselves with you, are there others that come forward that kind of are illustrations that when you're calling to memory, when you're trying to explain to people what it is that you're seeing, and you're hoping that they'll open their view, their lens. Are there other stories that...
Do you mean are there stories that seem more encouraging or...
No, not at all.
Maybe the other direction. Then.
Yeah, or
cautionary.
Just could be.
Yeah. Well, the book that you've mentioned is probably got 30
yeah.
or more of those kinds of things. Okay, alas, this is not going to sound like a winning formula, what I'm about to tell you. But of the hundreds of people that I worked with who are dying, easily 95% of them died badly. And by any sane measure of what dying well or badly is, they did die badly. I don't mean they were writhing in agony. I don't mean body fluids flying around the place. Almost universally, they were sedated. Okay, so you wouldn't have been able to, quote, see anything. No tearing at the bedclothes, none of the stuff that you've probably seen on the job. A non-event, by and large, that required sedation for what? For what's called in the trade terminal agitation. Now, terminal agitation is like prose for what? It's prose for too late. That's what.
Too late for what?
Yeah. By too late, I mean this. You know, if you're willing to, you can know that that time's coming. You can know it from a long way off. You don't need any news. Nobody with a stethoscope has to tell you that. It's there to be learned. Everybody's death before your own is your chance to get a PhD in how it is. Okay? Now, you stay away from that stuff, you know, at some considerable risk to yourself and to the people who you claim to care for, because you're going to come to your dying as a complete amateur, as a real rookie making the classic rookie mistakes, many of which are devastating, like too much treatment, like bargaining for more time, like arguing with the physicians to no point whatsoever about who's really in charge and whose life is it, et cetera, et cetera. The stories I'm trying to tell in the book and when I'm teaching and even in the film are not examples to be or not to be. Okay, you didn't see a lot of deaths. Okay, now you've seen three more by watching the film.
Yes.
Okay, you haven't seen a lot of deaths because, you know, your way of working doesn't give you the chance to do it. Most people's don't. Okay, I write a book. I got 30 of them in there, more or less. Why? Well, if you can't get to it one way, maybe I can give you another way. Okay? You're not there in the blood and guts time. It's not required. What's required is to know what I call the human scale mysteries of dying. They're completely mysterious, and the more you learn about them, the more mysterious they become. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean you wring your hands, you know, in futility. The sedation I was talking about is a consequence of refusing to learn. I'm not saying it's punishment. It's a consequence. I wish otherwise for us all. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to go that way.
Yeah.
People are not sedated for end-of-life pain, friends. They're sedated for end-of-life suffering. I'm telling you, most of the suffering comes from a refusal to learn. So plant the tree 25 years ago. Start learning you're dying now. You don't have to be sick to do it. By the time you are sick to do it, you're probably pretty good at it. And you're trustworthy, you know, for the younger people around you.
Yeah.
In other words, good dying, the consequence of dying well is that it conjures a village-mindedness around you. It gives a lot of people a lot to learn, to see, to do, to feel, and not to avoid.
Yeah.
And the consequences of bad death is every one of them corrupt our capacity for village-mindedness.
Right, right. And it also avoids the isolation, too, hopefully.
Can do.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 91.1 Cayucas, 91.7 Paso Robles to Salinas, 95.1 Lompoc, 90.9 Santa Ynez, Avila Beach, and Cambria. We have about 15 minutes left to wrap up today's discussion with Stephen Jenkinson, author of Die Wise, Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, and subject of Grief Walker, a 2008 National Film Board of Canada film featured recently at the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival. You can call us at 781-3875. We probably have time for about one more phone call. You talked about the concept of bargaining for more time, and there were a number of stories in your book about bargaining for more time in different. There are a lot of different ways that people do bargain for more time. Can you talk a little bit more about how that feeds into what we've learned and what that looks like?
Okay. And I'll say again, you're not going to be able to translate what I'm saying into should or shouldn't.
Correct.
Okay. There's more important things than having an opinion about what we should do, no? So I'm trying to testify here. So, seeking more time when somebody tells you you have a terminal diagnosis is completely in keeping with being alive. I'm not disqualifying it for a second. And when it's my turn, check up on me. And more likely you'll find that I'm rolling the knuckle bones of fate too. See if I get a little more.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You get almost anybody in North America, depending on where you live and how skillful the physicians are and how compliant you are, is going to get some of the more time to bargain for. It's not a fantasy anymore. It's almost a given. Mm-hmm. Anybody in treatment probably has had their life extended before they got to palliative. Okay, so you're in the more time. But the future orientation of hopefulness means you're never allowed to inhabit the thing that you've been gambling for. You're always looking to it instead of living in it. Now, how would you carry yourself if you were there? If you prayed for more time and your prayers had been answered, like that, probably that story you remember from the praying lady.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I that's what I asked her. How would you know if your prayers for more time had been answered? And she had no answer.
Yes.
Because praying is like hope.
Yeah.
Sorry, folks. But it is. It's future oriented. Okay? Nobody prays who's doing fine with the way it is. And it's the same with hope. So, if you were in the more time that you imagine for yourself, would you require more of it? So be more true. There's no such thing as truer more time. You're either in it or you're trying to get it. Mm-hmm. If you're in it, it's its own reward, no?
Yeah.
Unless the fantasy is more time means more health, rolling back the symptoms. You see, the pre-morbid restitution. If that's what you're bargaining for, somebody's got to tell you that ain't coming. And most of them won't, because no. Being hopeful is supposed to deliver better outcomes just universally. So along comes this rap of mine, which says, hope not required, way overrated. Quality of life? I don't think so. It's not necessary. More time? You got it already. So what else? What else? What else is you're alive, dying? You don't have to choose between them anymore. It's a kind of healthy person's stupidity to think that you are one or the other. So you're a living person dying, and you don't have to trade one for the other. And the more time means you walk around a little cocky. Like, mm-hmm. Look at me.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Mm-hmm.
But in our time, it's important to also know that more time means more dying. By any measure of that word, that's what it means. So understand, like Lazarus. Some people know the reference. Like Lazarus, okay, nobody asked him if it was okay for him to be yet dragged back across the edge of the threshold, no? So, and then he's left, and we don't know what, but he had to die twice. Well, that's people who are in more time. You saw your dying coming, you bargained for more time, you got it. It's coming again. And this time, is it your executioner? Is it a torment? Or do you get to... Folks, we're having an outbreak of Ebola or something right in the studio here as we speak. Yeah. No, we're good. Well, I'll continue. And if we have to phone anybody, we will. So more time is more of everything. And once you've glimpsed the end of your days, you can be better at it. Right? Not ambushed by it. Not ripped off when more time doesn't turn into centuries. It turns into weeks. More time with the grandchildren, if that's your age, great. But also more time with all the symptoms and all. And so not an affliction, just a chance to get good at it. And then decide what enough already looks like.
Okay. Charles.
Yes.
You had a question?
I do.
I'll take over, Charles, because she's having a hard time with the mic right now. You go ahead, because we can hear you just fine.
First, thank you for your compassionate work.
Thank you too, sir.
And a teacher I knew once said, death comes as a deliverer and a friend. So my question is, could you share some thoughts on the locale where a person goes through death?
Sorry, do you mean the architecture of, like, what happens after you die? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean just the physical location, where you are, and how that can affect a person's death.
Yeah, you heard me a little bit talk about, in reference to that question about the telephone, if you heard that earlier.
Correct.
I think rather than location per se, which can doesn't necessarily always work out as you'd imagine, right? So you have an idea, you write an advance directive, you've described what the room should look like and what color it should be and all of that, and maybe yes, maybe no, not that relevant. I would say instead, the architecture I'd point to wouldn't be so much place as it would be the human architecture. That means we attend to a dying person's dying time, we attend to their deathbed, we do so as if it were a place of worship. That would be, I think, the best orientation. It doesn't mean you're silent, but it means your understanding of the etiquette is driven by something like this. There are mysteries afoot. Our purpose here is not to dispel them.
I see that your references are focused in on a room. What about outdoors?
Same. If it happens, if it doesn't happen, I don't think that there's, given how little the modern person's life is lived in serious concert and a deep love affair with, quote, outdoors, more of it's looked at through windows. I don't think there's any magic in somebody suddenly being underneath trees, who doesn't have a lot of time there. So better to say that what we're talking about is not trying to make dying as uneventful as possible or as pleasant as possible, but rather obeying the mysteries that are asking to be allowed in, that this is bigger than any idea you could ever have about it, and properly so, that you're a servant to what's going on, not a beneficiary, and certainly not a director. It's that kind of tone of humility that I saw so rarely when I was in on that business.
Yeah.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you very much.
All right. Gina, did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Isn't he still talking? No?
No.
Oh, it just cut off right in the middle. Okay. Am I on?
You are.
Okay. Stephen, I saw your film the other day. It was really wonderful to hear you, and also today. I have this question. I know people who have gotten diagnoses of cancer and have gone through the abominable treatments that are offered and who are alive today and having a wonderful life and are ostensibly, I guess, I don't know if they call it cured or not, but they no longer have cancer. Then there are others who get a diagnosis and die within however many weeks or months. So how do you decide? I mean, when you get a diagnosis of a serious, possibly terminal illness, mm-hmm. How does one decide if they should have treatment? I mean, is it just on the basis of the law of averages? Yes, we can cure this, or what?
No, it's certainly not that. And two, I can't and wouldn't give an answer that's supposed to be magically relevant
right.
to anybody listening right now. But having said that, yes, at some point you actually decide if you're dying or not.
Uh-huh.
What we do, in my experience, is we rely on somebody absolutely persuading us that this is so, or we rely on somebody defeating every instinct we have otherwise, and once we're defeated, that's when we, quote, begin to die. So if that's the orientation, you're dying already belligerent and overwhelmed and broken down. And so if I keep saying that dying is a human scaled thing, I mean, we're not being asked something that humans are not capable of when we're being asked to die well. But at some level, you have to decide that you are. You notice my answer is not, I'm not saying, and as a result of this, this is how you know if you should take treatment or not. The treatment question is in some ways a separate question. The treatment, what kind of treatment and so on, is, you know, you're not an expert in this stuff. I'm not an expert in this stuff. There are people who are. You take what they say, and then you rub it up against your vision for yourself, your dreams for whatever, you know, you had in mind for your life, your family considerations and things like that. They take a, the treatment decision takes a place. It's not the determiner of anything. It takes a place, just as if you have diabetes, your treatment decisions take a place. It's not the whole story. And the pivotal thing is decide not that you're going to die, which is not a decision. It's simply a philosophical noodling point. But decide that you are dying. You're going to be talked out of it by most people around you because it's not life-affirming to decide that you're dying when you are. Well, how insane is that? So I'm saying that I wouldn't put a lot of store in how much chemo. People mistake me for being anti-chemo, anti-treatment, anti-painkillers. Are you kidding? Not at all. I'm simply saying that these are not the magic bullets that anybody bargains on them being. There is no magic bullet because there's no dragon to kill. Dying can be the place where everything you've learned about life shows up, not for your sake, but for the people who are attending to you. It doesn't turn you into a spiritual genius, but it might turn you into somebody reliable and trustworthy. And when you die rancorous and flailing and refusing and feeling ripped off and so on, look, you're not trustworthy, okay? And I'm not sure that I would want any kids around you, because if that's what they learn about dying, that's going to visit them 60 or 70 years later. And we really want to craft sanity around dying, not comfort. Sanity is a much different calculation, and it's something that affirms life, not just the parts of life that we approve of.
Thank you for calling.
Much.
Thanks, Gina.
Thank you, too.
Stephen, you have coming up a couple more things while you're here in San Luis Obispo. Mm. You are going to be, tomorrow you're going to be doing a book signing and some readings from your new book, Die Wise, the Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, and that's going to be at the San Luis Obispo's Hospice of San Luis Obispo's Dorothy D. Roop Center from 4:30 to 6:30 tomorrow.
If my hand lasts that long, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's 1304 Pacific Street. Also then on Saturday, March 21st, from 9:30 to 3:30 at the Mission of San Luis Obispo, Mission Parish, you're going to be doing a training. And people can call in at 805-215-3082.
It's not full yet from what I hear, but it's close.
Yeah. And then there is going to be a Die Wise teaching July 7th through the 22nd, 5 days at Hollycock Learning Center, Cortez, South...
in British Columbia.
British Columbia.
That's right, straight north.
In Canada.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they can go to Hollycock.
Hollyhock.
Hollyhock.
Hollyhock, yeah, like the flower.
Ah, hollyhock.ca.
Yeah.
And check that out. Mm. And I want to thank you, Stephen Jenkinson, for being here today and for those people who called in. And I want to thank you for joining us on Central Coast Voices. Join Fred Monroe next week. You've been listening to Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert-Sargent.
Thanks, Joan.